Prepare your minds for a new scale of physical scientific values, gentlemen.
To a new world of gods and monsters.
The atmosphere has become so polluted with deadly germs that it can no longer be breathed.
Hello and welcome to the Martian Drive-In Podcast 113. My name's Terry Frost, and this time around I'm looking at two films, very, very different, but both a lot of fun. We're looking at an old VHS era science fiction movie called Eliminators from 1986, starring Andrew Prine, Denise Crosby, and Patrick Reynolds. Then we move forward to 2016 for a movie which is adapted from anime and also manga, and directed by Takashi Miike, and that is 2016's Terraformers. So we've got one Japanese, one American, one better than the other, but I won't tell you right now which one that is. So sit back, relax, I'll get the contact details out of the way, and the show will begin. The Martian Drive-In Podcast appears every 2 weeks. It's a podcast of science fiction, horror, and fantasy movie appreciation, and sometimes television. It doesn't matter if it's old or new, good or bad, black or white or colour. As long as I like it, it may show up here. There are also occasional roundtables where I get together a group of like-minded people and we discuss a particular topic of interest to genre film nerds. You can support the podcast by donating at patreon.com/paleocinema. You can keep up with podcast news at the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. You can leave reviews on iTunes and send MP3 or written feedback to cultguru@gmail.com. That's cult with a K. This podcast may contain adult discussions, so don't listen to it in the car while driving the kids to school. Hey, how has everybody been? It's been kind of interesting here, not necessarily in the best of senses. There are going to be massive redundancies where I work, and I may well be inveigled into them, which means I get about a year's pay as a going away money, and then the future opens up to me. Now, this is a little bit shocking for me, but on the other hand, it's also kind of an opportunity. I can work harder on the podcast, I can get a bit of writing about movies done, which I haven't really had the energy or the time to do in recent years. And I can move forward and just kind of see what the future brings to me. It's a little bit daunting because, you know, as people know, I'm 60 now, and it's a little harder to get jobs after a certain number of birthday candles have been blown out. Nonetheless, I'm not pessimistic about it. I'm a little scared, I'll be honest with you guys. I'm a little bit scared. But I'm looking forward to taking about a year off, doing a bit of travelling with Sal. We're still debating whether we're going to travel around Australia or go overseas. It's still very much up in the air. We do have the ability to do either. But, so times change, life changes. Change has been a constant for me for a very, very long time now, which is really strange because you would have thought after this amount of time it'd get easier, but it doesn't necessarily get easier. You do get more philosophical and you do get more ability to kind of adapt to it, but it is a little bit challenging. Nonetheless, there's some good things that have happened too, and I'm not going to dwell on the possibility of the axe falling on me. If it does, I do okay, and things will be fine. We don't have to worry about the house. The house is paid off, and life moves on. Now, having said that, we bought a new car. Yep, we bought a Toyota RAV4, which is an all-wheel drive SUV. Now, once upon a time before I met Sal, I had a girlfriend who left me for a woman, and she bought a RAV4. And my idea of RAV4s were that they were little boxy cars, and they were a bit no leg room and all that kind of thing. Apparently, they've stretched them out. They're almost a meter longer than they used to be. And it's really comfortable. It's a big car. It's the perfect car for traveling long distances, which we all want to do. And it's got all the cool things that the previous car, which is 11 years old, didn't have, like Bluetooth and USB ports and all sorts of other little bits and pieces. It's quite large, and we're taking a little time getting used to it. The thing that pisses me off, and I don't know whether you've bought a new car lately. If you haven't, you won't understand this, but here's what happens. It takes four people to sell you a car. There's a sales guy. actually three people. The sales guy, then he sends you over to the woman who tries to upsell you on kind of Tony Stark style armor plating for the car and tinted windows and floor mats and all sorts of things like that. Then there's the finance guy who talks to you about how you're going to pay for the car. We were lucky we paid for the car. But it takes three people in about 2 hours to buy a car. Used to be, yep, I want that one. Here's my money. Give me the keys. But apparently not. And then, of course, you've got to call up the insurance and do the insurance thing. And then it's complex. And then when you go to pick up the car, which is a couple of days later because they've got to do things like put the window tinting on and make sure you've got a nice car, all that kind of thing. And then what they do is they take you into a little showroom area and your car's covered in a great big red sheet, kind of like our quiz show prize. And so they tell you, here's your car, you can unveil it, and you've got to take this big red sheet off your car. They show you how to work it, they Bluetooth sync your phone to it, and they make a big kind of reality television production of the whole deal. Whereas Sal and I just went, we want the fucking car. We didn't want to go through a performance piece and a bit of theatre to get the car. We just wanted the car, which we got, and we're happy with it. But there's all of this kind of elaborate kabuki theatre that goes on before you get the car. And I don't know whether it's for us or whether they decided they wanted to make it a kind of ceremonial thing to get to hand over a new car. Either way, it's just not us. And we found it a little bit annoying. We took it for a drive. We've taken it for a number of drives since then. And it's an all-wheel drive, so we'll be able to go pretty much anywhere we like. Someone once drove an all-wheel drive car up to the top of the tallest mountain in Australia, Mount Kosciuszko. It used to be Kosciuszko, but we found out it was pronounced Kosciuszko, which isn't an enormous mountain. And you can actually, there's a walking track that goes up there, but someone once drove a four-wheel drive up to the top of the mountain. I'm not going to do that. For a start, Sally wouldn't let me. But, yeah, getting a new car is kind of fun. And it's one of those things where it's another part of life changing. And you spend so much time in a car that you get used to the old one. And then suddenly you get a new one which is bigger, brighter, has lots and lots of technology in it. It tells you what the temperature is outside so you can put your jumper on if you need to. And all that kind of thing. The next one I get, I expect it to drive itself, which I found out something interesting about. In Australia, driverless cars are going to be crazily problematic, apparently. I saw something recently about this. And the reason is a little unusual and very science fictional. Driverless cars, the algorithm that runs them and the AI that runs a driverless car, can't predict the way kangaroos jump across a road. They're good with cows and cattle and deer and sheep and rabbits and anything else, but there's a certain randomness and a sort of counterintuitiveness to the way kangaroos jump across a road that a driverless car's AI just can't deal with. Now, I've been on roads where kangaroos are jumping along the side of the road. That happens more frequently than you might think out in the bush. And yeah, they do. They are a random bunch of fuckers that can be kind of going parallel with your car on the side and then randomly leap out at you with no anticipation on it. There's no kind of looking over their shoulder to see if you're there. They just do it, which is one of the reasons why a lot of cars have roo bars on the front of them to stop them being smashed in. But apparently driverless car systems really can't cope with Australian conditions in the bush. So, there's unexpected things happen when technology changes, and one of which is that driverless cars in Australia are probably going to prang into kangaroos a lot more than driverless cars in North America hit deer. But that's the way things go. You know, we get to live on a continent that's not attached to a pole. You guys get to have your car dodge deers. I'm sure somebody will think up a patch or an update to do like a kangaroo AI update on driverless cars at some stage. But kangaroos have been around for a very long time and survived pretty well the depredations of Australian people over the last 60,000 years. So I think that they're going to be okay. And they're random ways will continue into the distant future. By the way, the kangaroos we get around here aren't the great big red ones that you get in the outback. They're swamp wallabies, they're called, and they're smaller, but they can still ding a car pretty badly. They're about the size of a really large dog sitting upright. And the swamp wallabies are at least as random as standard kangaroos. But anyway, it's probably time to talk about science fiction movies, that kind of stuff, because it is a kind of podcast. And of course, we start with what I've been watching, and none of it apart from the movies I'm going to talk about today has particularly been science fiction. I picked up a 3-pack of Randolph Scott Westerns. Now, they're not the famous renowned Westerns that Randolph Scott did in the 1950s with Bud Bedeker, which are the creme de la creme of pared-down minimalist Westerns. This one's one he did for the studios in about 1952 called Colt 45. And it's about a guy who sells Colt 45 pistols, has his pistol stolen, and has to get him off a bad guy, played with mustache-twirling nastiness by Zachary Scott, whose sidekick in this one is Lloyd Bridges. It's kind of a okay Western, but it was done on one of the ranches around Los Angeles rather than out in the Alabama hills where the really interesting Randolph Scott Westerns were done. It also stars Ruth Roman, a starlet from the 1950s that I like. And it's not too bad. I've actually got two other movies to watch on that 3-movie set. So I'm looking forward to doing that, but I just simply haven't had time to at this stage. If you're interested in kind of classic B-Westerns, Colt 45 is okay. Now, Michaela Simpson and I were talking on ABC Radio Northern Territory, Radio Darwin and Radio Alice Springs, as we do every fortnight. Michaela was one of the substitute people when first it was Liz Travaskis, and then it's Rebecca McLaren. Liz went off on maternity leave, and Rebecca now has a baby bump. Congratulations to all involved. So Michaela was doing a substitute gig while Beck is sitting underneath an umbrella in Bali for a couple of days. So she picked the movie, and I like it when the radio presenters I work with pick the movie because, A, it means I don't get stuck into my own headspace and my own tropes and my own likes and dislikes. For a stage there, I was doing a lot of Audrey Hepburn movies, for instance. So she picked a 2012 Australian comedy directed by P.J. Hogan, who directed Muriel's Wedding, called Mental, which stars Toni Collette, Rebecca Gibney, Liev Schreiber playing an Australian, and Liev Schreiber does a very good Australian accent, probably because for a long time he was in a relationship with Naomi Watts, who grew up in Australia. He does a nice job of it. It's a kind of quirky, out there, transgressive kind of comedy, very feminist in the best possible ways, and it talks about mental illness in a way that kind of skirts close to the edge. If people are very serious about mental illness, then the movie Mental is going to piss them off enormously, and they may well get out the pitchforks and torches about it. But I kind of liked it. I liked the way it was empowering towards women. It was about their story rather than the guys. Anthony LaPaglia is in it, a very fine Australian actor who doesn't get anywhere near as much credit for the work he does. Check him out in a movie from about 15 years ago called Lantana, which is another Australian movie I recommend. Mental was totally out of left field for me, but I enjoyed it, and Michaela and I had a good bit of fun talking about it. It's got gross gags, really gross gags, in fact, all done by women. The C word is dropped frequently. There's all sorts of bits and pieces. I think the script needs a lot of tightening. It was semi-autobiographical by the director P.J. Hogan, whose family had mental illness in it, and some random stuff as well. But I think that a good script doctor could have tightened it up without losing anything. And I think that the movie may have needed that, and it might well have got it over the top to be a bit more of a cult film. But if you get a chance to see it, it's from 2012. It's called Mental. You might well enjoy it. And, it's a kind of feminist movie without alienating guys, or at least without alienating this guy. It's worth checking out, so you really should do that. Not too much else I've been watching. I've kind of been doing a lot of gaming because I'm trying to get my Destiny characters really adept on the Xbox so that when Destiny 2 comes out in September, I can level them up easily. Yes, it's a game thing, and it takes me away from my first love movies, but I'm going to have to do a podcast at some stage talking about the storytelling in games and how it's a game changer, boom tish. in a lot of ways, because I think there's some interesting things to be said there. But anyway, I'm going to take a break. When I get back now, we're going to talk about the Charles Band 1986 movie Eliminators, starring Andrew Prine and Denise Crosby and Roy Dotrice. And then we move on from there to much more recent Terraformers, directed by Takashi Miike.
In a hidden fortress concealed by impenetrable jungle dwells Dr. Abbott Reeves, a brilliant but devious scientist with the power to create.
Help them, androids, in the cage, Takara.
Any malfunctions?
I had some trouble with this. It feels like a delay in the neurosynapse trigger.
And the will to destroy.
Remove its memory and dismantle it.
It's half human.
He must be eliminated. Colonel Nora Hunter has the brains to mastermind the operation.
You need a full-time mechanic, my friend.
Fontana, the river rat.
What are you doing?
I saw this in a movie once.
When he finds himself in a tight spot, someone else has to pick up the pieces. Kuji, the ninja. He has the martial skills to destroy his enemies. The Mandroid. More machine than man. His special powers will determine whether or not they survive.
We got robots. We got cavemen. We got kung fu. What is this anyway? Some kind of damn comic book?
It is the most perilous journey any one of them has undertaken. And once they reach their destination, they face the most awesome power on Earth.
You don't understand. Soon I shall rule the world.
It will take all their combined skills to defeat him. Each one is the ultimate specialist in his field. Together, they are the Eliminators.
Okay, so Eliminators is one of those direct-to-video almost things that came out in the 1980s. There was such a need for product with the VHS revolution that everybody was making films and getting deals, particularly in Australia where we were just hungry for anything. Roadshow and all of the other distribution companies for VHS were looking for new things to come out. Every month they had a big swathe of new things coming out. And so they invested in getting the rights to a whole bunch of movies produced and sometimes directed by a guy called Charles Band. Now, Charles Band started out with a company called Empire Pictures and then went on to his new company, Four Moon Pictures, after Empire Pictures went belly up. He did a lot of films. The Trancers series with Tim Thomason, which here in Australia were known as Future Cop. Evil Bong is one of his more recent ones. Demonic Toys, Doll Man, again with Tim Thomason. Dr. Mordred, Crash and Burn. A whole bunch of different things, all in the genre of science fiction, pretty much, and horror. And just, you know, he was totally a kind of rival to Troma in a sense, though he didn't have the kind of transgressiveness that Troma had. And Troma, of course, produced somebody as prominent now as James Gunn, whereas Charles Band and his companies really didn't have a breakout star as a part of their lineup. But at the time, they were all over the place. I mean, I've already talked about one of Charles Band's movies for Empire, Zone Troopers, about the World War I GIs who meet up with an alien and fight aliens in the middle of World War II. But this one's kind of special because you've got the conceit of a villain, of course, who not only creates suits of armor a la Tony Stark, but also travels in time. He also created an android called Mandroid, played in this case by Patrick Reynolds. And then we get rolled into this kind of madness. Ninja the cyborg, a river rat played by Andrew Prine, very much tongue-in-cheek, a female scientist played by Denise Crosby, who a year or so later was in Star Trek The Next Generation. And, yeah, and it's got everything you need for a 1980s C-budget science fiction movie. It's got synthy music score. It's filmed in this case, Spain. Though the production values aren't too bad. There are some shots when they're traveling down the river in Fontana, the character played by Andrew Prine's boat, which has some nice special effects work. They're being chased by another couple of charter people, and then, of course, by the villains. Nobody's going to say this is the best film in the world. I'll be honest with you about that. And from my description, of course, it's fairly obviously isn't. But it's got a lot of fun. The villain, Abbott Reeves, is played by a British character actor called Roy Dotrice, whose filmography is really kind of interesting. He was in The Criminal with Stanley Baker back in 1960, Heroes of Telemark, A Twist of Sand, The Buttercup Chain, Nicholas and Alexandra, which was a very big historical drama in 1971 about the last Tsar of Russia. He was in Tales from the Crypt, Saturn III. He did some voice work on that, the movie with Kirk Douglas, Harvey Keitel, and Farrah Fawcett. He was in Cheech and Chong's The Corsican Brothers. He was in Amadeus playing the father of Mozart. He did some TV series, Shaka Zulu, Beauty and the Beast. He was in an episode of Babylon 5. And a whole bunch of... isn't an episode of Angel, for instance. The guy's still going. He's 94 years old, and he's still got a pulse. But Roy... and he's also in the pilot episode of Space 1999. So it's got a great genre history there, as indeed have a few of the other people. Andrew Prine, who plays the River Rat Fontana in this, was in Simon King of the Witches back in the 1970s and had a long history of acting in kind of B and C and D grade genre movies. Now, this one, as I said, it isn't a perfect film, but for me, there's a kind of nostalgic feel to it for a couple of reasons. I rented a shitload of films back in the 1980s and 1990s at various places. In 1990, I moved to Melbourne from Sydney, and I was kind of thinking back on those times a little bit earlier today, and one of the things I remember is it was very rare for people to actually own VHS tapes in the earlier days. There were some that were sell-through, but they tended to be things, you know, they had a few out for Father's Day and a few out for Mother's Day, and there were some MGM musicals that came out on sell-through in shopping centres and department stores. But for the most part, rental was where the bucks were at. Now, I was a bit fortunate, because before I moved to Canberra and then Melbourne, I lived in Sydney, and I lived in a place called Glebe, which is a very much an inner suburb. You can't get a house in Glebe now for about $5 million because fuck real estate. But at the time, there was a video warehouse just down the road from where I lived, and you could go and scrounge through there and pick up for $5 or $10 ex-rental copies of various films that weren't available in the stores, so you couldn't actually buy them. And there were some weird laws about the video stores selling you their ex-rental copies. So what they had at the time, the laws changed, but what they had at the time was a warehouse place where you go in there, and on the concrete floor, there were rows and rows of videotapes up on their spines there for you to go and scrounge in and find things. I mean, I picked up my first copies of TV episodes of Patrick McGill's The Prisoner there, and I picked up a whole bunch of Village Roadshow movies like Zone Troopers. I picked up my copy of Zone Troopers there, and Eliminators, and a bunch of other things. Every spare buck I had, which was quite a strain at times on my first marriage, I spent buying videotapes from this little warehouse place, which was also a distribution center for the local video shop. So they get in things and from the wholesalers sell them onto the video shops. And at that stage, the big ones like Blockbuster and Video Easy and all the other ones hadn't come through yet. So the smaller video shops were still had a foothold on the market. And so this place sold on to them. And they'd then get stuff back from the people they sold to,
and they then sell it to people like myself, who only lived about 150 meters down the road, which was nice work. So it was very hard to buy videotapes. So you go and rent these things multiple times. If you wanted to see Eliminators, or you wanted to see Doll Man with Tim Thomason, or Future Cop, a.k.a. Trances, you had to go and rent them multiple times. It was really a problematic thing. There we learned how to create a cross tape between videotapes, where you put in different leads and cross the leads over between two video recorders. And you had to get a little box to get rid of the Macrovision copy protection on it. Remember Macrovision copy protection? You had to get a little box to get rid of that kind of stuff. And ultimately, you could do a fairly reasonable copy of a movie with only an outlay of several hundred dollars. I was kind of lucky because I knew a couple of tech geeks who could get me the Macrovision stripping boxes fairly cheaply, so I picked up one of those without really breaking the budget. But my movie obsession started that long ago. In fact, it started way before that. But movies like Eliminators were grist for the mill in the same way that in earlier decades, 30 years before, AIP and companies like that put out a whole bunch of stuff for the drive-in market. It was a kind of iteration of that kind of thing. A new delivery system was invented, being VHS at the time, and Betamax, though nobody got Betamax. And so a need for product was created. These days you've got companies like The Asylum and all of those other kind of small geeky companies producing product for streaming services and channels like Sci-Fi, because they have a continuing ongoing need for any kind of product you can get, as indeed further on Netflix does. There are some kind of ropey science fiction movies on Netflix, because Netflix can't just live alone on stand-up comedy gigs and whenever Marvel decides to throw them a property. So if you check through Netflix and Stan and all those other streaming services, you will find a continuation of those kind of low-budget science fiction movies. The quality's getting a little bit better. The special effects are much, much better, of course. But this kind of B-science fiction thing, I don't think is going to go away anytime soon. There's a need for it. People like it and want it. You can't go top-end all the time. You can't watch Arrival forever. But these movies are kind of about a halfway between the origin of these kind of cult films, which are drive-in movies, and where we are now with streaming services that have a constant hunger for new product. So the VHS revolution, the creative movies like Eliminators, is right in the center of that. But, I mean, I do like that there's some really cool little bits in this film. There's the fact that Mandroid, which Patrick Reynolds, interesting actor, and I'll talk about Patrick Reynolds before I talk about what Mandroid does. Patrick Reynolds was the grandson of the guy who ran R.J. Reynolds' tobacco company, and his family got very, very wealthy giving people lung and throat cancer. But Patrick Reynolds kicked up about that. He was one of the first people on the inside to confess that they knew about the health-destroying properties of tobacco. And in fact, he started his own little foundation about it. And now what he does these days is he goes around and lectures about the dangers of tobacco from the insider's point of view. So Patrick Reynolds, even though his movie career never really took off, and he probably wasn't one of the most gifted actors, he did do a lot of training. I think it was with Strasberg School in New York to train as an actor. But where his real passion came along was telling truth to power as far as the tobacco industry is concerned. And so all strength to Patrick Reynolds. May he live long and prosper. But I found that kind of interesting. Then you've got Denise Crosby, who bowed out a season or two into Star Trek The Next Generation. I think it may have been even in the first season. I won't bother looking that up. But, yeah, she was kind of an interesting actor. She turned up later in other things such as Deep Impact. She has a mild role in Mimi Lehrer's Deep Impact, which is one of the underrated Earth Gets Shot from Space by Something Really Big movies, which I compare favorably to Armageddon. I don't like Armageddon because Armageddon's kind of like, see how big my balls are and my name's Michael Bay, whereas Deep Impact has a little more depth to it. The special effects are about on par, but I find the people's story in Deep Impact a lot more interesting than I do the people's story in Armageddon. But anyway, back to the Mandroid. Mandroid's really cool because he's got kind of the half face metallic thing. His arms and legs, he's got a chest piece as well. His arms and legs are metal, and he can kind of take his arm off and change it for a different weapon. And he has a tank, which is kind of cool. And it's a kind of half-track tank thing that fits to the back of the actor and makes him into a kind of tank centaur. So he's sitting up the front, wedged into this thing, and moves around on two enormous tank tracks. And that's very cool. I don't know where they got the device from, but it works really well, and it's a bit underused in the movie, but I kind of like it. I like the fact that it's almost like they were trying to sell him as a toy to Mattel, so they had to have all the little extra bits for the action figure. So you got all that kind of stuff in there, and as I said, the movie isn't perfect. The movie isn't really any good, but revisiting it and getting a copy of it, which is in Academy ratio rather than widescreen, because I think all these movies at the time made by Charles Band weren't widescreen films. They may have got a small theatrical release, but that wasn't their main market. I kind of enjoyed that. I did get with in the four disc set that I got Eliminators in. There's another one called Arena, which is kind of interesting. It's a kind of cross between Rocky and an Alien Babylon 5 kind of thing, which is kind of cool. And it has a whole bunch of alumni from various TV series, science fiction TV series, from the 80s and 90s. I didn't want to do that one because it's less interesting to me than Eliminators was. And I've also got America 3000, which is an Italian post-apocalyptic thing, and an Australian movie from 1986 that a few people I know worked on called The Time Guardian, starring Tom Berlinson and Carrie Fisher, which was a real dog's breakfast. I should talk about that at some stage and maybe even get someone who was involved in it to talk about it with me. But I got them on a four-pack. It cost me $8 to buy the four-pack of movies. And just for Eliminators alone, it was really worth it. Now, the wonder of Eliminators, mixing up ninjas and robots and cyborgs and time travel and mad scientists and female scientists and a cute little robot that does the scouting for them and makes beepy noises, is the work of two people whose careers I really like. And they are Paul DeMeo and Danny Bilson, who were the brains behind the 1990s Flash TV series starring John Wesley Shipp, amongst other things. They also wrote Zone Troopers, for instance, and Arena, the other movie I just spoke about, which is a kind of boxing movie set on Babylon 5 kind of thing. They really did have an interesting career, DeMeo and Bilson. They never really got to where they should have been. Had they been working in the industry at the level they were 20 years later, they'd be getting a lot more interest and a lot more fun. They were comic book geeks. In fact, they wrote a bunch of comic books as well. And at least Danny Bilson, I know, went on to be an adjunct lecturer at University of Southern California, where he talks about online storytelling and computer game storytelling and computer game character development. So they've kind of gone on to have not A-list careers, but DeMeo and Bilson's movies I really like a lot for the fact that they're unashamedly comic book geeks. They created weird and wild and unusual films. In fact, the biggest thing they ever did was The Rocketeer for Disney, and that was in development hell for a number of years before it was finally made. And anything really cool in that is down to, of course, Dave Stevens, who wrote the original Rocketeer comic, and Paul DeMeo and Danny Bilson. But I think the biggest weakness in Eliminators, apart from all of the other weaknesses in Eliminators, is the fact that one of the characters sacrifices themselves at the end to save everybody else. And the movie ends with the surviving characters cheering because they beat the bad guy. There's no grace note there, acknowledging the sacrifice their comrade made to let them prevail. So that kind of doesn't sit well with me. I don't think it would have cost them that much to put in a little scene there. It may well have been in the script, but when it was filmed, and by the way, it was directed by a guy called Peter Manoogian, who also directed Arena, again from a Bill Sandomeo script. It really doesn't play that well because of that. But at that stage, there was a kind of tight time limit on things. There were budgetary restrictions under Charles Band, who doesn't have the best of reputations among some people. But, Eliminators is very much of its time, and I kind of like that 1980s synthy score. Bad laser effects and little squibs blowing up at various places. The innate sexism of it's kind of there in this film, but it's not as over the top as it is in a lot of other films, and I think that's down to the screenwriters who didn't tend to go to the sleazy end of the market when they were making their scripts. But the movie kind of works for me, and I keep watching it every few years, and I get a little nostalgic pang for VHS days. The transcription copy of this on the DVD isn't great. I don't know whether it was done from a master VHS original or not, but it's very watchable, and at $8 you really can't go wrong with it. So I'm going to take a break now. I want to get back and talk about a movie that I picked up at random at JB Hi-Fi, our local go-to interesting movie place. They were doing a 20% off sale, which is always a little bit of a magnet for me. And it is Takeshi Miike's Terraformars from 2016, a very unusual movie about the terraforming of Mars.
地球が人間で溢れ返った今、唯一の望みが火星というわけなんですね。火星に行くには少々危険な手術が必要でね。私行きます。この話裏があるに決まってるだろう。まもなく火星の大気圏に突入する着陸だ。人類存亡をかけたミッション。何も知らない15人が火星に送り込まれた。俺たちは犯罪者以下の人間なんだって。地球のゴミが火星のゴミ掃除に向か。
何してんだてめえ。あの化け物は何だ。政府はテラフォーマーと呼んでいる。
俺たち一人一人に昆虫の DNAを組み込んでいる。てめえ騙したな。
皆殺しだ。死ねない。こんなところで。俺より強い奴がいるなんて許せない。どこまで進化するのか。必ず戻ってくるからな。金がいるんだよ。生きて地球に帰れ。俺の友達だ。テラフォーマーズ。
Terraformers is a 2016 Japanese science fiction film directed by a guy who does some very transgressive films and then does some very commercial films, Takeshi Miike. We know him from things like Ichi the Killer and The Great Yokai War and all the other groovy movies he's done, Yakuza Apocalypse, for instance, and Blade of the Immortals. So, you know, Takeshi Miike, love the guy's work. Never seen a movie of his that isn't interesting, but Terraformars, it's two words, T-E-R-R-A, and then F-O-R-M-A-R-S, which is a bit of a pun because it's set on Mars. Now, the movie was based on a manga series that started in 2011, oddly enough called Terraformars. The story is a little convoluted and it continues past the movie. The movie is the third iteration of Terraformars, the first one being the manga. Then there was an anime TV series, and this is the film version of it, which is the version I got because I picked it up at random because of Takeshi Miike's name. From JB Hi-Fi, it was about terraforming on Mars, and there were people fighting cockroaches. So I thought I'd give it a go, and it's a lot of fun. The plot's a little, as I said, a little bit elaborate. In the 21st century, overpopulation had become such a problem that scientists began preparing for the colonization of Mars. This is from Wikipedia, by the way. The first step in the terraforming of Mars involved seeding the planet with moss in order to absorb the sunlight and create a hospitable atmosphere, as well as increasing the surface temperature. They also induced cockroaches in order to spread the moss. 500 years later, in the year 2599, a manned mission is sent to the Red Planet to clear out the cockroach colony in preparation for the human colonization of the planet. The crew is an international team of misfits and criminals who are given the opportunity to take part in the mission to gain forgiveness for their crimes. That's the setup at the start, and we get to see a little bit of the criminals in their natural environment. There's a very vague Blade Runner-y prologue with rainy streets and neon lights and flying cars and all the kind of usual Blade Runner kind of things. And when I saw that part, I thought, yeah, this isn't going to be very good. But then it gets to Mars and things get seriously and deeply crazy in the way that only certain kinds of Asian genre films can do. So here's the problem. In the 500 years since they terraformed Mars, the cockroaches have evolved. And they've evolved in a very interesting way. I'm going to make a picture of one of the cockroaches from this movie, the little snapshot for this particular episode, because they are bugfuck crazy creatures. Basically, what they are is great big muscly humanoid cockroaches, 2 meters tall, muscles upon muscles. They make Arnold Schwarzenegger look like DJ Qualls. And they have various degrees of intelligence, and they have the ability to evolve and adapt to circumstances. And there are millions of them. So this spaceship full of misfits lands. They put out, they shoot out a whole bunch of canisters of bug spray to kill the bugs, thinking that's going to get the job done, but it doesn't, because the bugs have developed an immunity to the bug spray. Meanwhile, on Earth, the guy that sent them there, a guy called Sasaki Baha, who's a very kind of foppish. He's a little bit like Zorg in The Fifth Element, with a bit more emo styling to him. He wants to get the cockroach egg back to Earth so he can study it and do all sorts of wonderful things. And what's the worst that can happen with it? And so that the whole mission is to bring back a cockroach egg and to destroy the cockroaches. Doesn't roll out like that. And then we suddenly get another iteration, another elaboration beyond that plot line. We find out that the company that sent these misfits to Mars, there's a terrorist, there's some thieves, there's a pervert, they say, who basically wants to rape women. There are some female criminals in there. There's a whole kind of mixed bag of social and societal misfits. Not only have they been sent to Mars to defeat a planet full of enormous 2-meter-tall humanoid cockroaches, but they've been genetically altered to give them insect-based superpowers. I shit you not. And then the movie starts getting deeply crazy, because each one of them has got a superpower based on some extraordinary characteristics of a particular kind of insect. And we get little vignettes as each superpower manifests. And to trigger the superpower, they've got to shoot themselves in the neck with some kind of vaguely snot-looking goop in an injector gun, in order for them to evolve into their insect superpower form. Like I said, this isn't your ordinary terraforming Mars kind of movie. One of them's got... I'm not even going to tell you what they've got. Some of them are superpowered. Some of them have got the ability to create flames. Some of them have got the ability to leap. Some of them have got the ability to turn to moss. And all... Basically, what's happened is the people who made the original manga have looked through reference works to find the weirdest powers that a particular insect has and give that power to one of the protagonists. And the interesting thing is that when they get to Mars. The cockroaches look kind of dopey. Their eyes are near the top of their head. They don't look like they're particularly smart. They're big and muscly. But we learn when they kill two people in about half a second that they're fast, they're intelligent, they can leap enormous distances, particularly under Mars's gravity, and they attack in swarms. And in fact, there's one scene where an armored carrier carrying the heroes has to roll through a rolling tsunami of these giant 2-meter-tall cockroaches. And visually, this movie is just fantastically over the top, and it's not like anything you'll see in a Marvel superhero movie or in a DC Cinematic Universe movie. You've got some of the tropes. It's kind of like they put all the different tropes for various kinds of movies into a blender and just mix them up and then made weird sculptures out of it. Because you've got the trip to Mars, the terraforming Mars thing. You've got the corporate stuff, which is slightly reminiscent of The Fifth Element. You've got the emotional stuff of the various misfits interacting socially and telling each other about who they are and where they are. They've got the bold captain who takes them there, who's very cool. Now, I'm not going to pretend to pronounce any of the names. I don't know too much about the actors. They seem to be a combination of good, solid character actors and J-pop stars. Because they've got to look good in the white spacesuits that they have, which are kind of form-fitting. But, so it's a mashup of all of those things and done in a crazily and beautifully inventive way. Just when you think it can't get any more crazier and any more bugfuck, literally bugfuck, it does. The movie just takes it that extra step, and there are some bits where you know something's going to happen, but you don't quite know what. And for me to see a movie that surprises me and takes things in a different slant, and we're told that they're genetically enhanced, but then we're not told how for a little bit. And then we find out that it's so they can get wonderful insect superpowers, which gives the actors a chance to wear elaborate makeup with big antennas on it, and in some cases claws and stingers and wings and all sorts of other things. There's some beautifully, wonderfully lovely costume and makeup designs in this film, which is really interesting for me. It's almost like they've gone, okay, what's going to look really good if somebody does it in cosplay? And then they've created that. The costumes do look a lot, very cosplay in a lot of ways, but that's not necessarily a negative thing. It really is a movie for the eyes and for the senses rather than to make any logical sense. This particular kind of manga and anime-based movie isn't going to have scientific rigor to it. It's all there just to basically give us an action film that's really interesting, give some characters that we can kind of like, show us a world we haven't seen before, and just take a genre to its ultimate crazy over-the-top limits. And that's exactly what Terraformars does. Now, the manga series has gone on with a whole bunch of sequels, and there's more backstory. There's the return to Earth by the remaining heroes at the end of it. There's what happens then. It's an ongoing saga since 2011. So there's now been, 6 years for the story to continue. From what I can see of the manga, it does look stylistically, a little bit different than the movie version. You've got to allow the movie people some license with that. And the bugs do look slightly different. In the movie, it looks like they're mocap. There may be mocap adaptations. And seeing millions of them attack a spaceship is kind of cool. The special effects work is very good. The CG cockroaches kind of work. At the start, you think, yeah, it's not a really state-of-the-art CG, but it grows on you. You kind of go, okay, well, I'll accept this because it's just so cool if I accept it, rather than going, oh, this special effect looks shit. In general, it works really, really well, and Miike's sense of momentum and outrageousness, which is one of his hallmarks as a director, really comes out in this. And he's done a number of things which have been very different from the stuff we know him from in things like Ichi the Killer. In 2006, he did a children's film called The Great Yokai War, which is about Japanese domestic monsters. And that one is visually very interesting. They got all sorts of things like the Umbrella Monster and Kappas and Kirins and all sorts of other mythological Japanese beasts done in a very interesting way. And if you can get a copy of The Great Yokai War, it'll be a great movie to watch with kids. It'll probably be a little scary for the younger ones, but I saw it a number of years ago, and I really should track down another copy of it on disc because I really like it. And I like the fact that Miike can jump between these very commercial projects and the personal ones, the things like Yakuza Apocalypse and the other things he's done, Ichi the Killer and stuff like that. He's really a... He's incredibly prolific as well. He directs 3 or 4 movies a year. And in spite of that, manages to entertain in every single one of them. And for me, the best bit about this in some ways is that visual inventiveness. And also, it reminded me how much I like certain kinds of Japanese genre films. I know I did Shin Godzilla a little while ago for the podcast. But I'm really going to have to go through and find some more of this kind of stuff because it is a lot of fun. And just when your palate gets jaded with watching American and English films, just kind of stepping outside of your comfort zone and watching things like this is really interesting. This one was brought out in Australia by Madman Entertainment under their Eastern Eye kind of sub-label. And I picked it up for $20, I think it was, on DVD, and I got a discount because it was 20% off. But I really recommend it if you're into this kind of stuff. And it's really has kind of taken me in the direction now I want to watch a lot more Asian genre films of recent years. I picked up just today for about $7 a Blu-ray of an anthology Korean science fiction movie called The Doomsday Book, which is 3 different science fiction stories by 2 different Korean directors telling 3 science fiction stories. I'm looking forward to watching that too. On Blu-ray for $7, I'm going to give it a chance. And this one looks like it may well pay off. And then I'm going to kind of go on a binge, I think, in between watching Westerns, which I'm on another binge about at the moment. But I'm going to go on a binge of catching up on some Asian genre cinema. I may well tap into my local expert on that, Grant Watson, who's been on the podcast before. He was previously on a couple of the live episodes I did at Continuum Conventions. And Grant and I have disagree enormously about some things, but he's very much tapped into Asian genre cinema. I really will have to tap him on the shoulder and just get him to recommend a few things for me that I can do on future podcasts because, I really want to kind of freshen my palate a little bit by going out of the usual Anglophone kind of things that I watch and talk about on podcasts. So I'm going to stretch myself a little bit there and just go in a slightly different direction for a while. But just to kind of summarize it, I don't think it's for everybody. I think that you've got to be in the right mood and have the right kind of sensibility to watch Terraformars. And once you accept the fact that these cockroaches are cockroaches evolved into humanoid forms, you can kind of go for the roller coaster ride. It really is like that. I have a constant argument at work at the moment for however much longer I'll be there, with people who think that Mark Wahlberg's Transformer movies are good. Now, I'm not sure if they're watching the same movies I am or whether their brains are wired strangely, but even for those people, a movie like Terraformars has got to be a lot better than watching Mark Wahlberg trying to emote while a whole bunch of CG aliens with alien robots with spiky bits all over them smash cities. And you know, Anthony Hopkins is in the latest one. What the fuck happened to Anthony Hopkins? Talk about your check cashing. But I won't go on a rant about that just now. But anyway, I'm going to find a few more recommendations, but Terraformars is one that I recommend. Sit down with a couple of people, get out a glass of sake or soju, And by the way, thanks to Tim Merrill for the soju. I still haven't finished it, but I will. I'm actually drinking at the moment just one, because I can do this in moderation. I'm on a pastis thing, French licorice liqueurs. So I've got a glass of Ricard with some water, and once you get past the intense licorice taste of it, it does go down very smoothly. But anyway, that's about it for this time around. As always, I'll be back next week with another Paleo Cinema podcast, and in 2 weeks with another Martian Drive-In podcast. I'll update you guys at that stage on the work situation. I've got a feeling that I may end up taking the money and run, to quote Woody Allen, but I'll let you know how that goes, and it'll give me more opportunities to watch Japanese adaptations of manga. So look after yourselves. If you're up north, stay cool. If you're down here, stay warm. Watch good movies, watch bad movies, keep watching the skies. I'll be back very soon. And by the way, Kerry Lanahan is the best boy in the credits, and the other Kerry is yet to have a title. But I'm going to play the credits for you, of course, to recognize and express the love for the people who support the podcast with as little as a buck a month, on Patreon. You can go to patreon.com/paleocinema for that. And by the way, the other thing I should mention too is our good friend of the podcast, Gary, put money directly into my PayPal as a way of supporting the podcast. And you can do that as well. If you need the details, you can contact me. But he whacked me a chunk of change, which went to upgrade a little bit of computer hardware that I needed. So thank you very much for that, Gary L. And in the meantime, here are the credits in the style of movie credits. Take care, people, and I'll be back very soon. Thank you to all of the Patreon subscribers. And here are the credits in the style of movie credits to acknowledge and thank all of them. We have Tom, our focus puller. Sarah, our special effects technician. Ian, our caterer. Grant, our technicolor consultant. Claire, our script doctor. Gary, our prop master. Morris, our music director. Jan, our dialect coach. Armin, our key grip. Matt, our rattlesnake wrangler. Elaine, our scientific advisor. Julia, our casting director. Chris, our camera operator. Christopher, our gaffer. Miss Jane, the wardrobe mistress. Tansy, the foley artist. Alyssa, the location scout. Mark, our second unit director. Paul, our special makeup effects director. Tammy, our donut wrangler. Tim, our New York unit director. Rabbi Steve, our spiritual advisor. Steve, our script doctor. Dylan, our goat wrangler. Eric, our set security lead. Kerry, our second script doctor. Richard, our set photographer. And our extras, Kathleen, Mark, and David. And let's not forget Steve Sullivan, our director of monster effects, and Richard C., our transportation co-captain. So thank you very much to all the subscribers, and you too can subscribe at patreon.com/paleocinema.